the first time we saw a signal, it was in my daughter. She was still very young, and we saw this beautiful stomach signal coming from her, and we could localize it in space across her belly. I said, wow, there's got to be some way you can use that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the Rosemann Institute at UCSF, the University of California in San Francisco. Today, our guest is Steve Axelrod, CEO and founder of G-Tech Medical, a company that is developing a wireless patch to measure the electrical activity from the stomach, small intestine, and colon. And why would you want to measure these signals? It turns out that there are lots of reasons. G-Tech's platform can be used to help doctors get a handle on many conditions, including irritable bowel syndrome and diabetic constipation. The quickest path to getting reimbursed, though always important in commercialization, is in the GI surgery, where it is important to know when your digestive system is working well enough that you can leave the hospital. G-Tech has been supported along the way, not only by the Rosemann Institute, but also Breakout Labs and the Fogarty Institute. We learned from Steve how all these players in the Bay Area ecosystem can help a startup. Enjoy the talk. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. The 2019 Rosemann Innovators application is now open. The selected innovators will receive coaching and mentoring, variety of in-kind services, and the opportunity to pitch in front of our early stage investors network. Deadline to apply is Thursday, April 18. And for more detailed information, go to our website, www.rosemanninstitute.org. Welcome. Thanks for joining me for the podcast today. It's been my pleasure to know you. Maybe you can start with a little bit about G-Tech Medical. It's a company that you started. Can tell us about like what technology that you're developing and what the disease target that you're approaching this product for.
Well, thank you, Christine, for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this. It's really going to be fun chatting with you. I love what you're doing here at the Rosemann Institute, so I'm really pleased to be a part of it. So G-Tech was actually founded by a different individual who had an idea based on literature and his background, didn't have the skill set to bring it forward, and so he brought me in as the CEO, and I took over in just about 7 years ago, November 2011. I've been running everything since. What we're doing is a diagnostic tool for the gastrointestinal tract. So it's a non-invasive wireless patch. We call it an EKG for the gut. So it works like an EKG in that it reads electrical signals from muscular contractions. But instead of those contractions coming from the heart muscle, they're coming from the muscles of the stomach, the small intestine, and colon.
So that's why do you need to measure the EKG for the stomach?
So there are something like 40 million office visits a year for problems like constipation, diarrhea, chronic abdominal pain, nausea, things like that. And most of these problems are functional. They aren't anatomic. So if you go to the doctor with several of those problems, they'll do a colonoscopy and it'll come back negative because there's nothing anatomically wrong. You probably don't have cancer or some other anatomic problem. They'll maybe do an upper GI series. And again, very often it comes back negative. And they'll do a colonoscopy and it'll come back negative, CT scan rather. What the problem with those tests are they don't measure function. They measure anatomy. So to measure function, you need a different way of doing things. And there really aren't very many good ways to measure function. There are several ways that get used on occasion, but they tend to be very limited to one organ at a time or in the doctor's office where everything is different or just for one meal. So what we've developed is a way to measure over several days, non-invasively, the entire GI tract with these wireless wearable patches.
So currently they do measure it in the office for like a short period of time because you don't sleep over in the office. but that's not sufficient.
Right. So maybe you'll eat some radioactive eggs and you'll stand in front of a gamma camera for most of the next 4 to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. So that will measure the emptying of your stomach and maybe a little bit about your small intestine on that particular type of meal on that day in the doctor's office, but not your entire GI tract. It doesn't tell you anything about your colon, right? And that GI tract is connected and it all works together. So it's far better to be able to measure the entire tract at one time. They have things like SitzMark that you swallow, little markers that they take x-rays of your GI tract a few times over several days and they try and trace them, but it's not very quantitative. Our system tends to be more amenable to being quantified.
And why is that better?
So if you're looking at a picture, the doctor may say, okay, it looks like things are not moving over here. It's very subjective. We're trying to quantify things, to say this is how much activity you had, this is how it compares maybe to a normal range in each one of the organs, responding to meals, if it correlates with pain, daytime versus nighttime. We've learned some very interesting things in the studies that we've been doing. For example, if I measure you in the morning and I measure you at night, there's very different results. But if I measure you again at night, it tends to be very similar to other nights. So we have something called the gut beat. You know, a heartbeat is about a second, and then a second later you get pretty much the same picture. The way the gut works is there's a gut beat that's 24 hours long. So if I measure for 24 hours and then the next 24 hours, it'll be very similar. Not identical, because your gut just doesn't work that way. You eat different food and you do different things. But that 24-hour period tends to be reproducible.
So does that mean maybe it's, you can tell the patient when is a better time to eat based on their gut biorhythm?
We're not aiming at that sort of health area. We're really aiming at diagnosing problems. So it'd be more like if a patient has irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease, IBS, Crohn's and colitis. As you know, my daughter has Crohn's disease, which is much of my motivation for doing this. It's more to see that there is maybe an irregularity or deficiency in one of the organs and to characterize it: too much activity, too little activity, dysrhythmic when it's supposed to be steady, and use that as clues to the physician in how to go forward and identify a more effective treatment more quickly and less invasively and less expensively than if you're getting colonoscopies and CT scans that are negative anyway.
Mm-hmm. And how, so the information that you gather through your device, how is it helping the clinician make a different kind of decision to help their patient?
So that's a great question, and it brings me to the point where I have to break our markets up into different areas. So this is truly a platform technology. It could help with people with IBS, IBD, gastroparesis, diabetic gastroparesis, constipation. But it also can be used in the hospital for patients recovering from abdominal surgery. And that's what we really focus on as our first indication to go to market with, because it's much simpler and it has fewer issues with reimbursement. As you know, getting reimbursement for a new medical device is challenging and can use up a lot of time and run through a lot of cash. So we're starting out in an area where the payment can be made from the DRG for the surgery.
And how big is that potential market for the patients with the stomach surgery?
So there are about 4.5 million abdominal surgeries in the U.S. every year. And if you count other surgeries that also tend to affect the GI tract, about 10 million every year just in the U.S. So that's a pretty good sized market. We've been doing studies in that area with Stanford Hospital and El Camino Hospital, and more recently, Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford. So just in the last few months, we published a paper in American Journal of Physiology, Gastroenterology, on 80 patients in Stanford. And then with the El Camino study, 18 patients in the Journal of Gastrointestinal Surgery just about a month ago.
I think it would be interesting, how do you approach Stanford and El Camino Hospital? Why those two hospitals first? I mean, besides being that you're being here in the Bay Area.
Well, we have a lot of connections at Stanford. So we're based at the Fogarty Institute in Mountain View, and that's at El Camino Hospital. So we walk across the street to get to El Camino. Yeah. And it's great to have a community hospital as well as a research hospital. So when we talked to the Stanford people, of course, they were saying, whoa, this is really cool technology. We want to do something. We can identify a specific group. In this case, it was patients recovering from Whipple surgery for pancreatic cancer. And so we have a research hospital on a very specific type of surgery. That's a very big surgery. And then at El Camino Hospital, it's nice that we're now doing something in a community hospital. And the surgery types there are more broad. They tend to be more small intestine and colon-based.
And give you different information and data that you would not have gotten.
Exactly.
Do you think the community hospital represent more of the real America?
So I think there are a lot more community hospitals than there are research hospitals. They have recruitment, of course, is much slower. It's why we have 18 patients at El Camino and 80 at Stanford. But I think it's very, very important to show that your technology can work in the hands of people who are not world-class research experts.
Well, that's good. So you mentioned earlier that you were asked by the original founder of this technology to become the CEO. What was your drive to join the company? You mentioned about your daughter. Can you tell us more about
that? Yeah. So, you know, I started out as an elementary particle physicist. I did my PhD at Yale and then went to Stanford for my postdoc. And then I went into local industry because I loved the Bay Area so much. I didn't want to leave. So I worked at a company called MeasureX where I designed nuclear and X-ray and infrared sensors. So my whole career has been about making measurements and interpreting those measurements and finding ways to use them. And then in 2003, I got into the medical device world at Zoft Microtube, and we made a tiny X-ray tube for breast cancer radiation therapy. And that was a startup, and eventually there were lots of layoffs. You know, we all go through that, right? And I was through one of the layoffs, I was a victim. And so I was looking for work and doing some consulting, and then I met this individual through mutual friends. And so at that point in time, when I heard about this idea, it intrigued me because my daughter has Crohn's disease. And also, it was just a really hard problem. I was very skeptical at first. Can you read at the skin's surface signals from your stomach and small intestine and colon? I didn't think it was very likely. But I kind of signed up on a part-time basis and started making some measurements. And the first time we saw a signal, it was in my daughter. No, it was she was still very young, and we saw this beautiful stomach signal coming from her, and we could localize it in space across her belly. I said, wow, there's got to be some way you can use that. Mm-hmm. And then over time, we started being able to see, pull out of the noise, because the signals are very noisy, and so my particle physics background really helps a lot in data analysis.
Was it at that time you said you're skeptical because you don't know whether that's going to work? But you jumped in anyway. Is it because you really want to solve this problem because of your daughter? Or you just feel like, well, you know, it seems like a cool guy that I want to hang out with.
So a lot of it, obviously, is my daughter. And a lot of times I choke up when I tell the story about how sick she was when she first came down with Crohn's disease and spent 5 weeks in the hospital.
How old was she when?
She was 13. So that was... She's 24 now, so 11 years ago. And I slept on an air mattress next to her bed for 5 weeks in the hospital. It was a very, very scary time. She lost 8 pints of blood.
Wow.
So that was a big motivation. But also, as a physicist, I just have to admit, it was an interesting problem. And, you know, as a physicist, we're very arrogant. We think we can do anything. And I think I can do that. I think I can do that. And wouldn't that be really cool?
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes we do need arrogant people to make things happen. And then you test it on your daughter and you can see the signal, but it's still noisy. And then what? Then you feel like...
So we started out, you know, we had very little money. In fact, I went 2.5 years without a salary at the beginning. So we came really close to selling our house. Fortunately, my wife was working, but really not making enough money for us to survive on. So we went through pretty much all our savings and a second mortgage.
So you're
mortgage.
Really in.
You're really in. Absolutely. You know. So at first, we just had EKG systems, like off-the-shelf kit EKG systems. And that's where we got signals. And we worked with some local gastroenterologists, and we showed some interesting things on patients they referred to us in an actual IRB-approved trial. And then we got our first funding from Breakout Labs here in San Francisco, and they've been fantastic supporting us. And with that connection, we also met people at the Fogarty Institute and got in there, and they've been equally fantastic for the last 4.5 years.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. And then, so now where are you? Hopefully, you have some salary.
Yeah, so just, you know how hard this is because you're involved. You get some money and then it's running out, and then you hope to get a milestone that can convince the next investor or sets of investors, and you get a little more money and you think you're going to be good and that the next round will be so much easier because it'll be so much further advanced. And you do make that progress and you make sure you got a milestone that you can talk about. But it's still hard.
Yeah.
It just goes on being hard. And you think, I'm going to submit this grant proposal. And it's so strong, there's no way they can say no. And then it turns out that you don't even come close, right? But you manage to hang in there somehow. And you just keep clawing and scrapping, and you hang in there. And so now...
So what, you know, who are the person who helped you keep on hanging there and keep on going, because it can be exhausting?
Well, you know, my wife has been super supportive, and I think I have 2 daughters, and my older daughter just got her PhD from Johns Hopkins, so they're
She's not
all,
helping out with the company.
She's not helping out with the company, but just knowing that the family, that my wife works at Stanford Hospital for over 30 years as a perfusionist and a nurse, so it's just, that's so motivating, right? And then my daughter, Lindsay, with Crohn's disease, who did work for the company up until she started school here at UCSF in the MTM program, that just motivates me, right? I feel like I'm doing something really important. I feel like this is going to be really important.
Okay. And so you had the study from Stanford and the El Camino Hospital with the good result. And what's your next step right now?
Yeah, so that's the latest milestone, that we published those papers. We'd had, I think, 13 posters at conferences. And those are great when it's your first thing, but by number 13, they don't count so much anymore, right? So the papers came out, and the results are really, really good. They show that in the middle of the second day after surgery, we can predict things that are going to happen 3, 4, 5 days later. So that will enable the surgeons to adjust the feeding schedules for patients to get out at the right time for them. Earlier, if they're doing well and anticipating it, if they're going to develop postoperative ileus, that keeps them in the hospital much longer to guard against that.
So this study is basically validating your device can predict how your stomach or the patient's stomach will react. And so it gives the data to the caregiver to interfere with their feeding? Is that what that is?
Exactly. So in the case of Stanford, they're interested in the stomach because of the Whipple procedure. In the El Camino Hospital study, it turns out it's the colon activity that is most predictive. And I think maybe your listeners will be amused. If there's any 12-year-old boys, they'll get a kick out of the fact that in that study, we showed that 36 hours after surgery, we can predict when the patient will have their first fart to within 21 hours, even if it's 3 or 4 days later.
I know. It's like you should be thankful when you can fart.
So that is That is a key thing. That lets doctors, as you were saying, determine when it's safe to feed a patient. And in many cases, it's faster than their protocols. In some cases, it's slower. So for each patient, it'll be personalized. It'll be what they like to call precision medicine to get them out safer and faster than they otherwise would have and with lower chances of readmission.
Yeah. So you mentioned about your device, you're going to plump it into the DRG. How does that work?
So the DRG is, you know, we don't have to go to the AMA and get a reimbursement code and then get the payers to pay it, which is even harder. So we just have to convince the hospitals that spending money on our system will save them money in the long run. So there's still a bar, right, to get over. We still have to do a trial where we prove that this information, we've proven that we have the information that can be predictive. The next step is for us to show that using that information that surgeons will actually succeed in getting the patients out earlier and healthier.
And what does that trial look like, or the study is going to look like? How do you design it?
So it's a step forward from what we've got now, and we're going to do it in baby steps. So Stanford's IRB has already approved for them to start using the data. So we've been working with them on what format we will show them the data, maybe in 12-hour increments. This is what this patient is doing, and this is what other patients who got through faster and patients who got through slower, this is where the new patient's data fits with respect to them. Almost like a blood test where you get a number and then there's a range. You're at the high end or the low end of the range, and let them use that in their overall gestalt of making decisions, not to be the answer, but just one of the pieces of input. So we'll use that with them and learn how best our data can be used by them. Hopefully it'll turn out to be something they can really rely on. And once we've got that nailed down, really understand how it's best used, then we'll do a two-arm study where we have patients where we measure them, but we don't give them the data, and then patients where we measure them and do give them the data.
Okay. And then how comparing those two, what are you trying to
accomplish?
Then
we'll look at outcomes. Then we'll show that the patients where they use the data had better outcomes, got out of the hospital faster, got out of the hospital healthier, had lower readmission rates, things like that.
Okay. And so your daughter has Crohn's disease, and how device like this can help? I mean, I know you were mentioning your first market for the stomach surgery patient. How about like for Crohn's disease, how is that going to impact patient outcome, improve the patient outcome for people with Crohn's disease?
Our vision for Crohn's, it'll be similar to patients with IBS, but different in the sense that Crohn's patients and ulcerative colitis patients have this disease for the rest of their life. And so they have regular doctor checkups, to see how they're doing. And they have a big challenge, and that is avoiding flare-ups. Flare-ups are painful, and they do damage to the GI tract. So they're really to be avoided. What we see as the opportunity is routine monitoring. Maybe every 6 months. We don't know what the actual interval needs to be. But routine monitoring, and what we're hoping is that we can see when a patient is in steady state, and then maybe we can see them pulling out of that steady state and going into flare-up.
So trying to reduce the number of flare-up using your device, allow them to kind of study what things that they can control to reduce their flare-up?
Yes. That's exactly right. So we don't know if that's going to be the case because we don't know right now. Doctors don't know what's going on in the motor activity or motility, the movement of what starts out as food through the digestive tract. They don't know how motility really relates to flare-ups versus remission. So we're very close to being able to announce that we're going to be doing a study. We have a promise of funding, but all the papers have not yet been signed, so I can't say the names of any groups. Mm-hmm. But we've designed a study of Crohn's patients at a major nearby hospital that will give us 300 tests. So we'll take 40 patients with ileocecal Crohn's disease that present at a clinic in flare-up. And we'll test them, and we'll test them three more times over the next 6 months. So four tests longitudinally. And then 30 patients that are Crohn's patients but that are in remission, we'll test them on that same schedule four times. So we'll have a real good baseline of what remission looks like. And then we'll also do 20 healthy controls.
That's really exciting. I'm looking forward to when you can announce it. Hopefully by the time we publish this podcast, then we can include that announcement.
That's very possible. It could happen today. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen next week.
So, I'm crossing my finger. So you've been doing this for 7 years now, and there's a lot of, you know, the bruises and bumps and bruises. What are the things that you learned that you overcome, and what you learned from that experience?
That's a tough question. There's a lot of things. One is, there's so much to know. When you go from being in R&D and having, you know, maybe having some success in developing products and thinking that you're reasonably competent, and now suddenly you're trying to run a company and you're making sure that you're handling things on the quality and the regulatory side and personnel side and worrying about money. And I can say that one over and over again, right? And legal issues and IP issues and covering all those bases. And also when it's a 2 or 3 person company, you're also one of the few people that are moving the technology forward. And in our case, we are also doing science. Since no one has made these measurements before, it isn't just about making the technology. We're actually establishing the science. That's why we're publishing some of these papers.
How do you manage your priorities and time? What to do first? Do you have people who help you, guide you? This is the area that you need to, step one, step two, step three, or you kind of figure it out as you go?
Well, I certainly have a lot of people helping me. At the Fogarty Institute, I have actually several different mentors that work with me at the business level, the CEO mentor level, and then in the individual areas like quality systems and regulatory and marketing and all. But really, I think for me, I manage my time always thinking, what's the next milestone? It's like the what's next, mm-hmm. right? And that's going to be compelling potentially to an investor. It seems like everything we do is thinking about an investor. If you're launching a trial, it's to get the data to publish something so that you can prove to an investor that what you're doing is real.
Right. No, I think that you know, what you're doing, probably that's very common. And because you do, you know, solving a big problem like that does require some investors funding and de-risking a lot of things that make them want to put money in you. I think that's really important. And how do you know what are the area next that it's something that the investor wants to see? Do you talk to them or do you kind of figure it out on your own? I mean, how do you know that is the next thing that they want to see?
I think a lot of it is, if you know what you're doing, I think it's fairly clear. I first need to show that there is a signal. I need to show that I can measure that signal, right, on the technical side first. I need to show that I can make a wireless mobile device that can measure that signal and can transmit it and process it, right? I need to be able to show that there's some meaning to those signals. And then you start getting into the things where maybe you do need to talk with your advisors and mentors about how important is it to get a quality system in place at what time. When should I start doing the market study that supports this? We already did some market work, but when do we need to get more formal? And things like that. It's sort of your knowledge, because you're doing it, you know, 12, 16 hours a day and you think about it all the time. But then also talking with your mentors and talking to investors and hearing what they think and trying to steel yourself to ask them to tell you the honest answer, mm-hmm. right?
And so, you know, 7 years is, you know, it's many days, and I'm sure you have something that you've done really well, and I'm sure there's some days that you've done something that dang it. What are the highs and the lows, if you could share with us?
Highs are always things like you've been working on this data analysis and you come up with this new algorithm. It's like, oh my God, look at what we just discovered. We just discovered that everyone has their own gut print. And if you measure them again 30 days later or a year later, you can recognize that gut print. That's a high. Hearing that you got a grant or that you're getting some funding, that's an incredible high. And then, of course, the converse is also true. Hearing that, or not hearing from that investor that you thought you were going to get money from, or finding out that your grant didn't even make it to second base, right? Or that you've been working for 2 weeks on this new algorithm and it's not as good as you hoped it would be, right?
Yeah. So what do you do when you're at the high? It's nice, you know, you feel elated, you feel like you can conquer everything. And when you're in the low, you feel like, oh, is this something that I want to continue doing? Or can I overcome this? How do you, you've been doing this, keep getting traction up. So obviously you have overcome your lows.
Yeah. And when they talk about a roller coaster, it really is. That is so true, Christine. The lows can last for a long time. And you think, am I ever going to get my funding? Or if you find the low point and you stop taking salary even, right, to get to that next milestone and get some more funding. It's like, am I ever going to talk people into putting more money into this? I think it's so great, but it's hard to convince other people, right? And you think, well, maybe I just don't know how to do that, or maybe I'm just not good enough, right? It's very, very hard, and you just have to be committed. I mean, for me, it's easier because I have that direct connection because of my daughter. There's no way I'm going to give up on this. Mm-hmm. There's just no way. I'm going to make this work. I'm going to turn it into something that makes a difference in this field.
Do you have like some dancing move that get you going to get going? Just like a rain dance?
Well, all my life I've found it's really important to exercise. So, I go for runs and I ride my bike to work. I'm so lucky. I live 4 miles from the Fogarty Institute, and so I bike to work most days. And thank God we live in California where I can bike to work most days.
That clear up all the stress sometimes.
It helps. I lift weights and, exercise for me is a thing that really helps a lot.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. Making the transition from nuclear physics, particle physics, where all your community are in that area, and now you're in this medical world, how do you see the difference between the two different ecosystems, and how do you make that bridge?
Well, I followed the traditional path from elementary particle physics to gastroenterology, right? No, I may be, I'm sure I'm one of very few people who have ever done that, but I went through starting out there in academia as my first career. My second career was in industry, and it took me a while to go from being that young, hotshot, arrogant physicist that like, oh, now you're making a product for someone. It's like, I don't want to make a product. I don't want to hear about customers. I want to do the science behind it. And I was there 15 years, so I eventually learned and became head of the group. And then I get into the medical device space with Zoft, and it's like, whoa, this is really cool. I went back from heading a group of 30 people, went back to being an individual contributor scientist for the first few years. But I loved it because I was doing something for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, instead of making a sensor for a paper industry, it was so motivating. And now doing this, I actually feel like it pulls together all these different things. So I've been doing some measurements my whole life. I did the medical device, so I learned about verification and validation in the FDA and quality systems. But that background in particle physics absolutely applies to what I'm doing now. Because when you do particle physics, you smash a beam, like a proton beam, at billions of volts or hundreds of billions of volts into a target or into another beam, and all these particles come out, maybe thousands of particles. You're reading the paper about discovery of the top quark or the Higgs boson. So you're smashing all these things together, and you're just sitting there measuring everything you can measure, and then you find the things that are interesting, and you come up with algorithms to pull out those interesting things. And then you see that, and you say, okay, I've seen these things now, but what does it tell me about nature? You say, oh, now I know about nature. There's this many particles, and these are the forces that interact with them. That's the same thing we're doing with the gut. Mm-hmm. So we're making a measurement of everything we can measure with these electrical signals. We're sorting them out. We're pulling out the interesting bits, this signals of motor activity from each of the organs, and we can tell them apart because they're at different frequencies. And now what we're focusing on is, okay, what does that mean, and how can we use it to help patients? So it's really very similar. It's all this big measurement and data analysis problem.
It's also your ability to connect the dot in terms of, like, you had that experience and how you can bring that experience to do what you're doing right now. So when you move from particle physics to device, is it by accident, or is just somehow this opportunity come and it's like, oh, that sounds cool, and I join? Or you're purposely thinking this is an area that I want to be in?
So the connecting the dots, you got to realize how long this has taken, right? And my ability to do that.
I don't know. I thought it was like 10 years.
You know, very long time, right? So I've always been really slow. But no, I had no idea that I would get to this. This is my joke about the connection between particle physics and gastroenterology. But as we discussed, because of my daughter having Crohn's disease, my mother died from colon cancer, and my sister is a survivor, and she has daughters that have basically undiagnosed GI diseases. So it's actually not just my daughter. It's really common in the family. So I think that steered me towards it. My wife being a perfusionist and a nurse at Stanford, and my daughters being now in the biology field, you know, it feels good to be part of that world. Mm-hmm. It's better than any other industry. It really is.
Yeah. As you can see that impact closer to you. And we all one day is going to hopefully don't use it, but you never know when you need it. Hopefully it's there. So changing topic to something more fun, lighthearted, I guess. It's almost the holidays. And hopefully you have some time to relax with the family. And I always like to ask my guests, because give me ideas about books to read or movies that you think that is really thought-provoking and interesting that you can recommend.
So my wife and I are part of a couples book club that came about from my older daughter's friends when she was back in high school 11 years ago. So we get together 3 or 4 times a year, have dinner and pick a book. And this next meeting is actually, it's my turn amongst the 10 members of the book club. And so I'm going to pick Bad Blood.
Oh,
the story of Theranos that I'm sure you're very familiar with.
And it comes through, highly recommended from a lot of people that I...
Have you read it yet?
Yeah.
So it's a great book because so much of it happened in the neighborhood.
Right.
I mean, I live in Los Altos, and when my wife and I go for bike rides, we often pass by the building that used to be Theranos's building, and it's got a new owner now. The new name of the company is Available. The sign out front on that building. So, you know, they talk about Pete's and Fuki Sushi and all these places,
right,
in the neighborhood. And yeah, and then, you know people. You're in the medical device space around here, and you know people who work there or interviewed there.
Yeah, it took me like one night to read through the whole book.
Wow, it's amazing.
It's a good, easy read. It's almost like a soap opera.
But it's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating, or maybe that's, I don't know if that's the right word to describe it.
One thing it shows is that those of us in medical devices, and you'll know this well, we care about what we're doing. We care deeply, right? But there are some people still that aren't really good players.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like you take a bunch of people that you really respect and admire, but not every single one of them is going to be perfect.
Yeah, and I think sometimes when a big, you know, what happened to Theranos, it get a lot of the publicity, and then somehow that is, you know, in a big public, then they feel like they paint a lot of people like that, which is not true. And
well, that's one of the scary parts, right? That people can read that book and think that that's more common than it is. And you and I know how rare that is.
Right. And I think it's sometimes with the world situation right now, we all feel like, oh my God, what's, you know, going on with this world? But there's a lot of good thing has come out for the last decades about where we are. But we forgot because that didn't make it to the headline news.
Yeah, well, you're right. It's not a headline that every day you have people like yourself trying to help other people come up with devices and cures and diagnostic tools to help society.
Yeah, we need to have more of that, you know, CNN for that, I think. A feel-good news outlet, that's what.
That's a great idea. You know, Christine, you know a lot of people. Why don't you do a podcast?
So, yeah, that's my hope. I think, you know, through my work, we meet a lot of people like you who are passionate about trying to improve patient outcome and, you know, risk a lot of things, willing to take the risks to make a change. And we really want to highlight that. So thank you. It's been my pleasure to get to know you for the past couple years now.
Well, thank you, Christine. Thank you for inviting me to be on this and for being part of the Rosamond Pledge Group.
Okay, great. Thank you.